If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
What has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here, it was supposed to be the distributors, but that was rescheduled. So I'm now here with, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it, so perhaps you can help us out.
Welcome to Millennial.
Elthempelar. Okay. Yeah. And this is your first time on Millennial. It's another debut. So welcome to the show. And before we get into the actual topic, could you introduce yourself briefly?
Yeah, I am mostly known for writing lesser-known parts of history, late antiquity, Bronze Age stuff. I have a certain interest in trying to draw across the various influences of what we now call Western civilization and trying to understand it as a continuum. I think people tend to isolate the different historic eras of Europe and, you know, more broadly America, whereas I want to try to view it as more of a continuum of history that builds on itself over time. So I think one of the things I'm most well known for is a Substack post attempting to decouple the Judeo-Christian stuff that's been endemic to the American religious world. And that still gets likes on Substack every week or so. And I think people like that. More broadly, I take a really deep interest in late antiquity. I doubt the claim of a dark age. I've seen enough texts from late Roman, early medieval to kind of see a continuous arc of history in that era. It's not as well documented as other areas, but I find it a fascinating era where decrepit old systems die, bold new systems rise, and bold men rise to lead them in times when no one else was willing. I guess recent stuff on the Twitter sphere, there was a Roman helmet guy talking about the Goths, and Musk was arguing, no, mass migration didn't end the Roman Empire, and he kind of just like pointed out like 40,000 Germans crossed the Rhine into an empire of tens of millions, and they conquered the entire thing in 4 years, but not really 4 years, but in a few years. They radically changed the West in just 4 years because they were well-organized, dedicated to each other as like a tribal group, and they were willing to do what needed to be done to change the world in their favor. I find the Dark Ages to be really a closer to present day Age of Heroes, like kind of like the Greek myths. So hopefully this will hopefully focus on that and hopefully will provide some insights into what was happening at that time period and hopefully some reflections on what we're going through today.
And what is the period of the Dark Ages? Just for anyone who is listening to this and doesn't have Google to hand or isn't terribly well educated on history, when did it begin and when did it end?
Most people, there's no real fixed date, but people have their preferences. I do prefer to say the earliest parts of the Dark Ages you could put it to is when the Goths crossed the Rhine in 406 AD. That's a bit early. Most people would put it later in 570 when Rome is sacked a second time and the imperial system really comes crashing down. But I would say, you know, that the cultures that become the Middle Age countries, that starts as an embryo when the tribes cross the Rhine in 406. And I would say that the Dark Ages, as we understand them, probably ended with the coronation of Charlemagne the year 800, basically. So you have about, you know, give or take 350 years of history there. Although personally, I would tend to say the Dark Ages, I would cut it short. Charlemagne's when like the Middle Ages really begin, but the Dark Ages start to enlighten probably around the Merovingians take over a century and a half before Charlemagne.
Right, okay. And where would you like to begin this this story?
So I guess we'll go to that first page of the presentation and I'll go over my little second page of the presentation because the first page is blank. Blank for effect, okay. Right? So all right. In order to really explain what happened in the late antiquity, end of the Roman Empire, we really have to explain, I really have to get over what made Gaul stand out. Most people know France was really where civilization reemerged after the West folded into an era of chaos. But why is that? Why did France end up being where civilization started sprouting from again in the early Middle Ages? And I would say to understand that, you actually have to go back to when Caesar conquered Gaul, because the things he did set Gaul up centuries later to actually be a stable place. Now, what exactly was Gaul, how it was conquered, and what are the consequences? So Caesar divided Gaul. He wrote his Gallic Wars journal, kind of like a war journal, documenting the people and places he went. Some he killed, some he conquered, some he integrated. And he divided Gaul up into really three primary regions, but you see there's four. The Belgae up north, what we now know as Belgium and in the lowlands, he considered that more Germanic influenced. It was still Celtic, but it was Germanically influenced. So he considered them kind of half Germans. Celtica is obviously the heartland of the Celts in Western Europe. And that's really the more where we get the idea of Gaul, the Celts, and that whole ethnic identity. And to the south there in Narbonese and Aquitania, we have kind of like old Europe, areas that were inhabited by people before the Indo-Europeans entered Europe. They're really ancient cultures. They're thousands and thousands of years old, and they were just there. And you know, their languages are unique and isolated, especially in Aquitania. These are like Aquitaine and the region, the area, the languages there, they're most similar to random languages in like Babylon and something like that. They're just so isolated that they didn't develop anything like in the Indo-Europeans. And the south there, Narbonesis, that's actually the Greek part of Gaul. Many people don't remember this or don't know this. Gaul was colonized by the Greeks first. And so the south part of Gaul had a significant Greek and Hellenistic influence. It was really the cities were Greek. The countrysides were Celts that integrated into Greek identity. They were Hellenized Celts. So they worshipped Hellenized versions of the Celtic gods or just the Greek gods in general. Centered on Marseille. Marseille is the oldest city in Gaul, probably. And it's the most developed. It's thought that Marseille was speaking Greek up until Charlemagne, which is actually rather fascinating. Greek in southern France survived the Roman Empire briefly. It seems to have collapsed once the Muslims sacked the city sometime in, I think, the 700s or something. But there was still Greek being spoken in southern France long after the Roman Empire fell, which is something to really think about. It had that little portal into the Eastern Roman Empire from which knowledge and wisdom could still emanate through the ruins of the West. If we go to the next slide. Did I get cut off? Oh, there we go. Okay. So more broadly, I want to also say the idea that the Celts were these unwashed barbarians living in mud huts, it's not really a true statement. The Celts did have cities. They were primarily wood and stone built, so they didn't last as well as the more pure Roman stone architecture. To the bottom parts there, you see some renditions of the Greek elements in Gaul, where they really took on a kind of like pseudo-Trojan identity. Some of the Greek colonists came from Anatolia. Some of them came from the Hellenistic heartland in Greece itself. But it was really a powerhouse of this like noble forest culture that built wood homes that were well ordered. They weren't random mud huts in the middle of nowhere. They had sophisticated architecture. And then you had the more traditional classical architecture to the south in Marseille. Famously, Gaul's main contribution to Roman identity was much of the legionnaire's outfit, such as the helmet, was originally a Celtic invention. The Romans liked how it worked, and they took it when they took over Gaul. The thing about Gaul, though, that I want to really emphasize is when Caesar conquered it, he did something unique that didn't really happen elsewhere in the empire. First of all, he famously brought in a number of Celtic aristocrats, the noble families that he conquered. He brought them in and made them senators. And this was a bit of a political thing. He wanted more senators to vote in favor of him, so he brought in a population to vote for him. It's one of the earliest instances of a minor population, not so much replacement as, you know, bringing in new peoples that will vote for you for political purposes.
Importing a better electorate.
Yes. Caesar practiced importing a better electorate. Not really sure how many senators he brought in, but the Roman Senate did grow. There's quite a number of records of the grouchy Italian senators saying, like, what are these trouser-wearing Gauls doing in Rome? Send them home, Caesar. Kind of late life of Caesar when he was causing a ruckus. But that is a very unique thing. Typically, what happened when Rome conquered a place, it brought Italians into that place to rule it and set up Italian institutions to rule over the population, creating a Italian domination of the region. Caesar set Gaul up that it maintained some local autonomy. The elite that had been there since age immemorial, like these people that had gone through druidic practices and had their whole civilization, they kept their land. They kept the landed estates, they kept the farmlands and everything. And so when Gaul was conquered, it's really more accurate to say, I mean, yes, Caesar conquered Gaul. He slaughtered a lot of people, probably exaggerated the numbers, but we're talking about like at least hundreds of thousands killed by Caesar. But of the tribes that allied with him, they maintained some degree of autonomy over the lands they had traditionally ruled. And as a result, throughout the early Roman Empire, even as Italians took over Spain, North Africa, Thracia, Mosia, Illyria, and these areas were like, and even Egypt, where like primarily Italians took over, plus the Greeks maintained some degree of this as well, which is probably why they fared better in late antiquity as well, because the Greeks also had some degree of self-rule. The Gauls had some degree of self-rule, which also meant that direct taxation and direct profit of the land didn't go, it went primarily first to the Celtic elite rather than the Romans. Obviously, if you're an Italian senator and you're interested in expanding your landed assets and vineyards, this is an offense to you. This was land that should have gone to you and brought in more income for you, like what happened when they conquered Carthaginian land in Spain. Here, the Celts kept much of their land and thus kept much of the primary profits of the land into the early empire. If you go to the next slide, I think I have an image of from HBO's Rome where it's kind of like a silly scene, but that upper right hand over there, that's the scene from HBO's Rome when the Celtic senators enter the Senate and Caesar essentially expands his political influence.
Ah, yes, I haven't seen the series. I'm my apologies.
but yeah, so as a result of this greater autonomy, even like two centuries later, when the crisis of the third century started happening, you had the Celtic regions of the Western Empire break off because they kind of already had their own institutions, their own hierarchies, their own world. It's kind of fascinating that like they could easily break off from from the empire when it had a crisis and just go on like nothing was wrong. They didn't have to get sucked into the crisis of the third century. They could just wait it out. It wasn't as much of an influence upon them. Roman emperors had to reconquer Gaul and Britain when the empire pulled itself together after the crisis. But it's worth noting that this region had a kind of nascent nationalism to itself. It felt like it was part of the Roman Empire, but distinct. And that's really important. Gaul had maintained a sense of distinctness from the rest of the empire. If you go to the next slide, I can actually show an example of this, I think. So this is the Arch of Orange in southern France. It's a couple miles north of Marseille. And when we think of triumphant arcs of Rome, we usually think of, like, you know, the Roman soldiers carrying out the menorah in Judea, or like besieging Carthage. That there are these buildings that display Romans shaming and embarrassing the conquered people, right? It's like this moment of like haha, we got you. The thing about Gaul, and this was built, I think, in the early empire. It might have been during the reign of Augustus or a little bit after him. So it's very early. Like, Gaul had only been conquered for less than a century when this was built. But it's interesting, unlike most triumphant arches, this arch isn't really about shaming the Celtic people. It's not really about the Roman domination of the Celtic people. It's actually more accurate to say it's celebrating what Gaul has brought into the empire. Within the images there, you see, rather than images of Romans sacking and sieging and looting Gaul, you find the Gauls on one side of the bargaining table, that center left image there. The Gauls are on one side bargaining their future, and the Romans on the other side. They're almost in an equal setting, which is really unique for arches. It really demonstrates how the Celts and the Romans were building a different relationship than other provinces. This is one of perhaps not equality, but like mutual respect. There's also a surprising amount of Greek influence in this arch. In the lower right there, that's actually sculptures in the style of the Greek Baroque. And it's thought that this is probably because there were still Greeks in southern Gaul, and they put their artistic talents to work in this Roman architecture. So you still had the Greek influence. There was always a Roman love-hate relationship with the Greeks. And when they were building these triumphant arches in southern Gaul, the Greeks were able to show their contributions to Gaul. You also see these icons and the rest of the images of things that were taken from the Celts, the armor, the shields, the icons. These are not so much looted as what Gaul is bringing into the empire as a partner. And that really, that makes this rather unique as an architectural example, where the way in which both the Gauls and the Romans wanted to show the public what this new normal was partner, not conquered and conqueror. It was a different relationship. And to some degree, this kind of hints at that Gallic nationalism that was growing, that endured through the conquest and ended up being kind of integrated into the Roman Empire. Even in the top right there, you see icons of ships, the trimeres. And of course, Gaul was not particularly known for its navy, but it did have a lot of forests. And one of the things Gaul contributed to the Roman Empire is its forests. It built ships for Rome. It made Rome's navy powerful. It gave Rome the iconic legionnaire outfit, the armor set. It made Rome, what this is really showing is that Gaul is making Rome what it's known for. It's helping as a partner in the empire. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. I love getting people's thoughts about this triumph, because it's really unique compared to the usual Roman bragging rights that show up on triumphs.
Oh, well, this isn't my area. And unfortunately, when I don't know how to react or interact with this kind of thing, because I simply don't know enough about it.
That's okay.
What I was hoping was that you could explain how this kind of thing was connected or relevant to the present day. Because otherwise, sorry, go on.
Yeah. I would say that one of the things I want to emphasize is that in every Western culture, there's that kind of like native group that may not be part of the imperial, well, it's part of the imperial core, but it's not the same identity as the imperial core. And it tends to develop a kind of local nationalism within the nation or empire. In the United States, we have Dixie, of course, the traditional warrior core of the American empire that is like, you know, occasionally breaks into revolution, but is always the base by which the United States military recruits its warriors from first. And you know, in England, you might think of it as more like the Northlands, and outside of the London core, there are these areas that have a local identity. And initially, this starts as a partnership, but for some reason, when nations get more powerful, that partner tends to be overlooked, abandoned, and like kind of pushed to the side in favor of new demographics. And so, even though Rome and Gaul start as partners, as the empire spreads out, this initial partnership starts getting abandoned to some degree. The Gauls are those like Free Nilly folks up north, and they give us great legions for our armies. But, you know, from the perspective of the Roman senators, they don't get landed profit from that area. They don't have vineyards there. They don't have farm estates there. It's more locally owned. And so as you get into the second and third century, Gaul starts getting this like cold shoulder from Rome, because as the senators become more interested in profit and where they can get their money from, Gaul isn't one of those places, so it gets sidelined. And that initially ends up being like the Celtic Empire breaking off, where like, well, if you don't want to care for us, we're going to seek our own stuff. But it really shows up in 406 AD when the crisis hits, when the Roman Empire hits its real first empire-wide crisis. If we go on, I'll speed up a little bit more to get to that more relevant to modern day. So the Goths are a newcomer to the empire, and the Goths are, they get things for Rome. Initially, they're an enemy. They enter in Andropolis and Thrace and cause a big havoc. But Rome likes the Goths and as well as hates them. It likes them because they're warriors and they take land and get profit. They loot, they raid. And so initially as an enemy, the Goths are this weird, they're actually kind of like the Dark Age mechanized infantry. They're known for creating these things called wagon leggers. At the Battle of Andropolis, these wagons of infantry drawn by ox encircle themselves into like a mobile fort, and the Romans can't figure out how to fight them, so they just have to withdraw. And the Goths enter as this like brute force that's looks like some new population they can actually get profit out of, unlike the Gauls. And so initially they start lining the Goths up as mercenaries along the German border. They start seeking ways to find how can we get profit out of Gaul by bringing in the Goths. How can this population be brought into Gaul to get us more profit by ripping off the Goths, ripping off the Gauls? How can they raid Gaul for us? And that initially ends up being a situation where the German border basically gets replaced from the Gallic legions to the Gothic legions. The Goths man the German border. They keep the rest of the Germans out, and they get to like kind of occasionally loot the Gallic border towns and send the profits when the Romans ask for it back home. And so this starts to become a bit of early forms of replacement population where along the Gaul-German border, the population starts getting replaced with Goths slowly, more so in the military, in the forts, but gradually into leadership and who can get the taxes out of Gaul faster than the Gauls themselves, who are a little stingy on the income. So as we go into the late antiquity, Gaul's relationship with Rome starts to decay because of this now increasingly adversarial relationship. The Romans are increasingly thinking, how can we replace some of the Gauls with Goths to get more money? If you go to the next slide. So as an example of this, Gotland is one of the heartlands of the Goths. That's that little island east of Scandinavia there. This is a map showing Roman coin caches. And one of the interesting things about it is some of the larger caches are outside of the empire. And so what we can find from this data is that money is being taken for payment for serving Rome, and some of it's being siphoned back to their homelands. Slowly but surely, that little island off the east coast of Scandinavia there, that has like 400 or 300 caches of coin compared to other parts of the empire. It's kind of evidence that the Romans are paying the Goths off to do things, and the money's getting sent back to their homelands. And this is starting to create it's playing with inflation. The Romans print the money, they pay the Goths to raid East Gaul, and then the money ends up back in their homelands, and the money's getting leaked out a bit. Something similar to what's happening now with immigrations, where populations are brought in, they start replacing it, the money ends up heading back to their homelands, and you're kind of wondering, like, well, why is this happening? If you go to the next slide. And so the storm really arrives in 406 AD when the now predominantly Germanic border legions face a large number of refugees coming over from Germany. The Huns are raiding Germany, so a lot of the Germans are trying to flee Germany into the Roman Empire. And example, General Stilicho on the Rhine front, he gets a soft spot for his kindred. So he has a little bit of in-group preference, and he decides to kind of let the Germans cross the Rhine. It's frozen in 406, but this is one of the first examples of the populations the Romans have begun to bring in are now starting to favor their own instead of the Romans. It's a consequence of replacement population. So those areas of Gaul that had been slowly been replaced with Gothic warriors, now those Gothic warriors are bringing in their families kind of illegally across the border. And you eventually hit the point of 4-6 AD where some 40,000 Goths crossed the Rhine into Gaul. And the Roman Empire is faced with this immigration crisis. And they debate it for a little while, but they decide, well, we don't get taxes from the Gauls as much as we should. And if these raiders take over those areas of Gaul, they'll own the land and they have contracts with us, so we'll get the money. And this leads to a little bit of a crisis where the Roman Empire decides to let Gaul burn. They decide it's beneficial to us if one population is driven out and this population is driven in and pays us.
Is this an example of Rome trying to be a multi-ethnic empire and finding in the end that it would have been a hell of a lot simpler to remain mono, to remain like the, yeah. the Romans were indisputably in charge?
It is an example of that. The Roman Empire in the, and this is maybe an area where I'll blame the Christians here. This is right after the, I am Christian, but I'm going to blame it. This is right after the Theodosian decree, which expands Roman citizenship from just the ethnic Romans to all tribes that are loyal to Rome. And it's the point where Roman identity dissolves into, do you pay your taxes and are you like a civic nationalist rather than an ethnic nationalist? you should read the Theodosian decree. It's a fascinating little document that basically transfers Roman citizenship to do you bring us money rather than are you one of us? Now, by this point, Gaul had been heavily Romanized and, it was considered Roman. They called themselves Gallo-Romans now rather than Gauls. So they were like properly Roman people, but they still had local autonomy from their traditional institutions that Caesar allowed to exist. And from the imperial government's perspective, this is them saying, well, this is an awfully great opportunity to clear out all those traditional identities and institutions and replace them with ones we directly control and can tax. And so from 406 to 409, the Romans just let Gaul get destroyed and raided and sacked so that they can bring in those taxes on the Gothic mercenaries. The Gothic mercenaries, they had to pay them, but the taxes that of the lands that they govern go to them. So it's a way for them to dissolve the Roman identity to who makes them money and dissolve the local institutions into what makes them money. This doesn't get taken very well by the Gauls, and they end up going along with a usurper of sorts. Constantius III, I think his name is, icon is right there. He decides, well, if the imperial government isn't going to send any legions to stop the raiding, the obvious land grab that's happening, he'll declare himself not a usurper of the existing emperor, but his argument is, well, there's no emperor in the West here, so I'm the emperor now. I'm still loyal to the emperor in Rome, but he's not here. And so this begins the interesting shift in Gaul from partner to, oh, I'm in an abusive relationship. How do I get out? If you go next slide. So this is kind of like a look of it. Constantius III, he starts in Britain, and he's initially defending the Britons from a lot of these Saxon raids that are happening along with the Goths coming in. And so you see there, Gaul is still technically part of the empire, but the nobles of Gaul write letters to him. Hey, we hear you're doing, you're playing emperor in Britain. Could you come to Gaul and get rid of these damn Goths for us so that we're not ransacked and can keep our lands? And Constantine III says, like, yes, I will. I'll cross the channel and save you guys. And so if you go to the next slide, the map changes to show just exactly how much land he gobbled up. And see, that's a dramatic shift right there. He basically takes over like all of Gaul, and then Spain kind of breaks away too because they're dealing with this mess. And so within 4 years of the Goths entering the empire, France, Spain, and Britain are a complete mess. The experiment to clear out the local autonomous leaders backfires, and the empire, the Romans basically lose control of large swathes of the West. And like, oh, you can't just bring in a foreign population and replace the people we want to tax. You actually have to like integrate them with our global wild. And this obviously leads to a mess. Constantine the Third creates his own institutions with the Gauls. And the thing that makes him popular is that he brings in the nobles to high office and brings them into local leadership, something that the empire really didn't want involved with. Like, they still wanted basically an Italy first situation. And the Gauls were like, well, if we're not even going to be second, we'll make a Gaul first institution. If you go to next slide. And it gets worse, but ultimately the Romans realize, okay, well, now we have to integrate this horde that we brought in to clear out the mess, to clear out the people we don't like. And where do you think they decided to settle these German barbarians?
Not in the heart of Rome, surely.
No, not in the heart of Rome. Any place that allied with Constantine the Third, who at this point I think gets deposed and assassinated, any place that declared allegiance to a power system, a power structure that was competing with Rome, gets a German settlement. So they purposely settle the foreigners in areas of higher nationalism. It's tactical. The areas in which they choose to put the Germans are the areas that were loyal to the usurpers. And this reveals that the imperial government, if they're going to have to deal with this mess, it's going to be the problem of the local nationalists, not them. You know, Italy doesn't have to deal with this problem. You have to. And this is perhaps reminiscent of things that happen nowadays. Of course, most famous when Biden took over, he settled foreigners in areas that voted for Trump. That's rather on record. And there's an interesting parallel to that in this era. I don't think people really know that. Like, it wasn't just random. It wasn't just, you know, here's a bunch of Germans. Oh, I guess we got to sell them somewhere. No, the Roman Empire was tactical. They settled foreigners in areas that showed local nationalism in order to suppress it and keep the empire the biggest dog in town. Anywhere that was loyal to a usurper got 10,000 Germans. And then they had to deal with these like unwashed, uncivilized barbarians and the time spent.
I mean, it's like Amazon or any of these big corporations deliberately having a mixed workforce because that prevents unionization.
Exactly. And in fact, it seems to be that they were settling them in areas traditionally, I think I remember correctly, traditionally where the traditional legion recruiting areas were, those legions that were, you know, they had a tight-knit community. There were, you know, veterans settled in the area. The veterans owned the land. Their sons fought in the legion. Because those legions had gone with a usurper to protect their lands from this foreign invasion, those hotbeds of, not hotbeds, well, areas which were previously sources of legions now became chaotic and having to deal with criminal barbarians that didn't know how Roman law worked. And obviously the consequence of this is that you're hurting yourself because now you have a smaller legion recruiting base. So in many ways, Italy is, the Italians are lowering their future recruitment to lock in greater reliance on the state. They're sacrificing power for stability of a single power source, if that makes sense. But it's like, it'll backfire because now you're going to have fewer legions to recruit from, because obviously no retired legionnaire is going to send their sons to fight for an empire that's raiding their villa.
Go on.
Yeah, so this leads to aristocratic radicalization, let's put it that way. There is a quote by Charles Perlmutter III. I'm going to paraphrase it, but one of the things that happened is that the legions didn't enter Gaul to bring the area under control until the usurpers rallied the legions. So rather than dealing with the barbarian crisis, they dealt with the usurpers and they let the barbarians keep raiding and looting so that the landed assets would be directly taxed by, you know, directly. You have a federati, which is a military charter with a foreign people. The people settle on there. They extract the taxes directly. So even though Rome's paying for the soldiers, they're getting taxes from the barbarian rulers of the land rather than the local lords that would have put the money into local infrastructure. It's kind of like a backwards way of colonizing your own empire almost. That causes the previously, they were loyal elite, but they were invested locally. They've now increasingly become radicalized. And one of the things that the local elite start doing is, if we can get enough payments to these Goths that they serve us, we can stick them on the Romans. And so, again, the Roman plan backfires a little bit, and now they have to deal with barbarians allied to local nobility rather than them. So, again, it's just this like really ass-backwards way of running your empire, where the main goal of the Italian elite was to acquire these historically untaxed and unowned lands and bring them into control of Italian nobility by means of sticking these foreigners on them, but now the local nobility is buying them off from you. So Rome didn't realize that if your loyalties are based off of income and you don't have the biggest coin, they're just going to switch sides. And so the Goths would ultimately switch sides between the Gauls and the Italians back and forth, depending on who in any given year had the money. It's a complete breakdown of loyalty and hierarchy for in favor of just pure market forces. If you go next, aristocratic, right? Yeah, that was the same one. So this is kind of an example of where the Romans are now competing to control these foreign people with the Gallic elite. Jovinus there in Gaul, he's kind of like the successor to Constantine II, and he basically has a lot of money from the Gallic elite, and so he starts buying up Visigoths and Alans and various people. Alans are interesting. They're actually Iranians, and so for a brief time, you had parts of Europe ran by like foreign Iranians, pre-Islamic Iranians, but just random Iranian generals running parts of the West, which is like interesting that it's not the first time it's happened in France. But the pink areas are areas that are like tangentially controlled by barbarians that the Romans own. The purple areas are owned by barbarians that the Gallic elite own. And so you kind of get this like competition for demographic control, where whoever has the most amount of money, they're going to buy the local foreigners to run the show for them and get the money, get the policing and taxing and taxing enforcement directly from them. And so this is really a breakdown of that partnership between Gaul and Rome. And now you have a certain radicalization amongst the Gallic elite. Okay, we have to get our money together and buy these barbarians so they work for us rather than Rome. If you go to the next slide, I think this is going to be, yeah, Gaul and the Roman longhouse. So this ultimately ends with Rome getting sacked in 410 and a bunch of emperors being assassinated by chaotic barbarians that aren't getting paid. And so shit's falling apart. And what happens to stabilize this is this woman, Galla Placidia, who is a daughter of Theodosian. So Theodosian, again, is the Christian who expanded Roman citizenship to all peoples rather than just one ethnic group. His daughter decides to marry a foreigner, you know, not too far from the tree. And she marries a man named Adolf, of all people, ironically, spelled Athof. Athof over there. Athof is a unwashed barbarian. I think he's a Visigoth in Spain. And so she marries him in order to basically longhouse some of the Gauls. You know, you have to do what I say. The wife takes control of the Gothic household, and she basically uses her status as the daughter of an emperor to kind of be an empress. And what she starts doing is longhousing barbarians, if you will, marrying them off to Roman women and controlling them through the wives. These barbarians have now taken land, they're gobbling up local money, they're getting lazy, and they're marrying. So she decides, well, this is a great opportunity to use women to control these barbarians, which is kind of interesting. You end up having a situation where the empress, if you will, she's not a proper empress, but she's kind of like the regent of the emperor, and so basically an empress. she's basically running something like a grooming gang to control the foreigners, similar to what's happening in Britain now. She finds Roman women, prepares them to marry barbarians, and then pays the barbarians off with sex, basically, to keep them stable. And this starts a kind of really bad situation where we're not really sure how many women got sold off to barbarians, but this was the means by which the Roman court, not so much the senators and an elite, but the Roman court, used degeneracy to control the barbarians in a really weird and twisted way. She actually sets three generals up in Gaul, Spain, and North Africa to compete for her graces and keep them in control by those means. It's kind of messed up. But one of the things about Adolf, the man that she picks, is that she manages to make him loyal to Rome, essentially. If you go to the next one, you'll see, next slide, you'll see a quote by Adolf once he took over Spain. At first, I wanted to erase the Roman name and convert all Rome into Goth. I longed for Romania to become Gothia and Adolf to be what Caesar Augustus had been. But long experience has taught me that the ungoverned wildness of the Goths will never submit to laws, and that without law, a state is not a state. Therefore, I more prudently choose a different glory in reviving the Roman name with Gothic vigor, and I hope to be acknowledged posthumously as the initiator of a Roman restoration with the Goths. He's an illiterate, unwashed barbarian. This is written by Gallia, basically his like his mistress, the Roman empress that's married him.
Right.
But it is rather interesting to see how this, like, after you bring the people in and you have to control them, one of the means that the Romans decided to control them is basically through these grooming gangs. And it kind of worked in a tragic way, where the barbarians settled down and sort of civilized and helped rebuild the Roman mess in the 420s and 430s, essentially by being longhoused. I don't know what you think about that, but it's a bit weird.
It's it is a difficult thing to grasp. Essentially, the Gallia, I suppose it was a match. She did some matchmaking in order to calm these men down, the leaders.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, her. I wrote down a note. Her success stabilizes the West through pitting men against each other to keep power balanced, rather than focusing men against the enemies at the gates and within, tearing the empire to pieces. This marks a structural turning point where Gaul stops expecting the imperial court to be its partner in local affairs and begins to view the empire almost like a gladiatorial game of survival. Other regions of the empire are other gladiators to defeat. One of these men that she puts under her control is Aetius, the famous Aetius, who decides, this is kind of fucked up, maybe we should try to fix this situation and get back to being a proper country. He manages to work his way up to becoming the supreme commander of Gaul's army, kind of like the equivalent of a first minister. And Gallia also, much like some women leaders in your own history in the UK, she starts to devolve powers from the Roman Senate to local authority. There's something called the Council of the Seven Provinces that's set up in Gaul, which is kind of like a devolved parliament in Gaul to run it and be a place where the barbarians and the Gallic elite can kind of like negotiate matters without the empire having to constantly get involved. But it's interesting that once a woman takes over, the strength and vigor goes out, it becomes devolved, local, and sex-based. Aetius, however, uses this council to kind of start rebuilding that Gallic institutional locality that existed before this chaos. And he's really the author of what one might call a Gaul first movement. And his idea is, well, Gaul right now is the only stable part of the empire. Italy's been raided and sacked. Spain's burning. Gaul was burned, but it's stabilizing. If the empire is to survive, we need to pick the strongest part and build it from there. And so he makes, through the Council of the Seven Provinces, he makes direct deals with the barbarians, brings them into his sphere of influence, and kind of starts growing a base of support, almost like a Gaul first movement. It's almost like a Gallic version of MAGA. If you go to the next slide,
I think I'll start showing some of that. This is just more of Gallia Placidia. I want to skip over her life. I kind of already went over it. We actually have a pretty good example of what she looked like because she was into the arts and recorded her face a lot of times. If you keep going, that's just one of her many. Again, Christianity is kind of causing this, unfortunately. Keep going forward. I probably should have mentioned these things earlier, but so Aethys starts recovering much of Gaul. That's the Longhouse. Next slide. Sorry, I'm going to keep going until I get forward to where we were. Next slide. Just once the Longhouse is gone, this is just the chaos that I was talking about. So Aethys, he starts looking for strong men to kind of get over this matriarchy. There's this series of letters that are written at his height of power, and they're rather interesting. They're during the time when the Huns are starting to come in, and so as a result of the Huns coming in, even more Germans are entering the Roman Empire to get away from the Huns. But I find this letter in particular, these are two letters, which kind of get into the heart of what Aetius was doing. He's ruling through Valentine III, but he's writing these letters. Aetius is an educated man, so he writes the emperor's letters. He keeps in contact with the Goths, and he's trying to like find a team of strong men to deal with this mess. So the letter he writes to the Goths is interesting. He says, "Bravest of nations, it is the part of prudence for us to unite against this lord of the earth, the Huns, who wishes to enslave the whole world." One of the parts of this letter that are interesting is like, you who have been given a third of the empire must come and serve me, which is an interesting way of saying it, because now that Roman identity has devolved from its ethnic identity to political identity, the Goths are being treated as Romans. In this letter, you see the Goths are being called Roman leaders. They're called, being called Romans, being called those who rule a third of the empire. They're co-heirs of the empire. So the Roman identity is now basically gone. It's now just who is loyal to the empire. It's civic nationalism now. And of course, Theodoric, the king of the Visigoths, he says, "Romans, you have attained your desire. I will make war with Attila." And it's an interesting turning point where a new social contract is now being built out of civic nationalism, because ethnic nationalism has basically collapsed. Well, not so much collapsed. Roman ethnic nationalism has collapsed. Now it's a tribal nationalism. And so now the Romans have to deal with this new reality where every tribe kind of has to be dealt with as an equal share of this empire, which makes running an empire, a multi-ethnic empire, is really hard to run, because you have to constantly compete with the demands of different tribes. If you go to the next slide, Aetius, he is somewhat successful. He repels the Huns, but at the sacrifice of giving away large chunks of the empire to barbarians who now demand it for their own homeland. They're now building their own homelands in the empire. And this kind of leads to a bit of a chaos with the Huns, where a large part of the Western Empire is basically now being run by foreigners who are calling themselves Romans because of Theodosian's decree. And it's really a question, like, how do you get that foundation around a stable Gaul to rebuild the empire? If you go two more slides forward. So what they start doing this is from Charles Paulminer III's notes that I mentioned earlier. He finds that in this time period, Aetius and others start creating these dynastic marriages to try to attempt to rebuild a national identity around Gaul. You know, how can you marry these different tribes into a actual leader? And what they end up getting is Avitus, who is this Gallic national, Gallic nobleman who has ties to the Goths through marriage and can start to form sort of an identity. I don't know for sure if you could call it that. If you go next, and what Avitus ends up doing, it's kind of, how can I say this? Avitus is a Gaul. There had never been a Roman emperor from an ethnically Gallic origin. And so when they try to rebuild Rome along a kind of new ethnic single identity, like trying to carve out a monolithic identity in this multi-ethnic empire, where like, oh, well, Gaul is the most stable. Gaul has the most Roman culture that isn't sacked and burned. We really just have to accept the fact that the Gauls are the new primary identity. Every other identity group in the Roman Empire cannot tolerate this, especially the Italians, who are basically being told, you're now second class in your own empire. And obviously, when a Gallic emperor comes to power, Italy immediately just breaks away. They're just like, no, we're not doing this. We don't care if we're going to throw away the entire empire. We're not bowing to a Gaul as an emperor. And so Italy breaks away, the Suebian Spain break away, and it just instantly breaks apart. You can maybe build a new ethnic group by carving one out of the multi-ethnics, but you're going to lose large chunks of your nation that aren't identifying with that ethnic group if you try to do it. This ultimately leads to Ricimer taking over in Italy, who is like a German warlord. And it's essentially the Italians would rather serve a foreign king if their ethnic identity is preserved, which is admirable, but they're now willing to basically throw away the empire if surviving in order, if the empire's survival means that the Italians lose premier status, they'll go with a barbarian king over a Gallo-Roman hegemony, which is, it's sad because, like, had it worked, it would have formulated into a Roman Empire with a single identity again and slowly pushed the Germans out. But instead, the Italians like, nope, we're going with a foreign king to counter your weird new ethnic mono-ethnic identity. So this is really the point where the Roman Empire basically dissolves into bickering nation states. But one of the things I want to point out, Avitus is ultimately killed by the Italians because they will not tolerate a foreign emperor, even if he can forge a new monolithic identity in that empire. But if you go two more down, this is an interesting point. When Avitus is killed, something happens that isn't well documented. It's called the Conortio Marcellina. It basically translates as the Conspiracy Marcellina. No one's really sure what this is. It's only recorded in as a single poem. But basically, for almost 2 years, Rome has no emperor because the Italians won't tolerate a foreign emperor and the Gauls won't tolerate a multi-ethnic empire. They're at an impasse. Whatever this event was, it seems to be that the young of Italy, the young men of the Italian legions, understood what the Gauls were trying to do and recognized it was necessary, but in order to do that, they needed to do it. It couldn't be the Gauls. It had to be the Romans to take over the Roman Empire, of course. Sidonius, Apollonius Sidonius is a senator who records only as a poem what happens in this two-year interregnum where there's no emperor. And he records it as when the Conspiracy Marcellina sought to seize the diadem while it was simmering, he had presented himself as a standard bearer for the noble youth in the faction, a man still new to old age. To eventually, because of the daring exploits of his fortunate audacity, he gave a gleam to the gaping chaos of an interregnum in his obscure lineage. For when the court was vacant and the republic in turmoil, he alone was found who, before many months had passed, dared to ascend the tribunal of illustrious power to administer the Gauls with fasces rather than odiciles, having barely completed the term of his final military serving, following the manner of payments, or rather legal advocates, whose actions ended only when dignity begins. It's hard to understand what he's saying, but essentially, the Romans realized Gaul had the right idea, but we have to do it from Rome. Unfortunately, it didn't work out, and this is essentially where I'm actually going to like cut it here because the rest of it's probably not as relevant. But I wanted to kind of like reflect on that, where in this late time period, what we see is really admittedly from the Christians, a breakdown of the Roman identity from the ethnic Roman to anyone in the empire. Then the consequences of that, where if everybody's a Roman, then everyone's going to try to be a Roman, and the empire dissolves itself, divides itself into pieces. But it really like ends up like just a mess in the end. It's ultimately a lesson that you can't really have a multi-ethnic empire. It's you can, but you can't have, like, there's always going to be one population that rises to the ascendancy, if you will. And that ultimately puts pressure on just, like, the total mess. I don't know if I... My apologies if I went a little bit too fast here, but I want to just reserve a little bit of time there to maybe go over what I've been saying, if it's not too rambly.
No, of course not. I agree, and to me it's instinctively obvious that you need to have, if not a mono-ethnic situation, then a situation in which one ethnicity is undoubtedly in charge. Because anything else introduces chaos and instability and insecurity. And it's not, it never takes long before people, groups start making a break for dominance. Mm-hmm. And everyone else knows that everyone else might be planning that at any moment. So
yeah,
it's an inherently... what's the word? Febrile situation.
Yeah, the thing that I want people to, if they find this interesting and read into it a little bit better than this rather rushed lecture, if people want to read into this, really pay attention to how the deeds of Caesar centuries before creating this partnership between two ethnic groups is actually the crux of why they couldn't work together when crisis hit. There had to be Caesar given Gaul's land over to the Roman senators, Gaul would have been valuable to the Roman senators when the Goths entered, and they would have fought and defended, and the empire would have survived. By introducing this little bit of demographic replacement, this little bit of bringing in a new electorate, even though it seemed minor in, like, what, 40 BC, it has a direct consequence on why the Italians and the Gauls weren't able to work together when the crisis hit centuries later. Their inability to work it out is why the Roman Empire fell. And this particular group here, the Consortio Marcellina, it was the last attempt of a working together before everything crashed, the Franks took over, and France was born. It was an alliance between rustic rural pagans, urban Christians, Goths that were civilized, to attempt to paste together a single identity in the late empire. But it couldn't work. It just didn't work. They couldn't decide who would lead this new empire, where would the precedent of power be? Would the fasces of power land in Gaul and Italy and Spain? Like, which group would be the leader? They couldn't decide. And ultimately, the reason why the Dark Ages came was that inability for a centralized power to share itself between peoples. If you're going to have a multi-ethnic empire, one ethnicity has to take control, because the empire is primarily serving one group. If it's serving more than one group, they're just going to fall apart. They're going to bicker each other for who this empire is for. Once Theodosian introduced the idea that all tribes can become Roman as long as they pay their taxes and serve, that creates a crisis where, well, now every ethnic group is going to want to be in the emperor's seat. Every ethnic group is going to want to be the emperor and take over the other groups. When it was just the Romans, even with Gaul as a partner, it was always a lesser partner. The Gauls weren't allowed to really hold high office. The delineation was clear. Gaul was a lesser partner, a provincial power in the Roman Empire. Once the Roman identity was dissolved into any tribe, it couldn't work. The Gauls immediately tried to seize power for themselves to protect themselves from the Goths. The Goths immediately tried to seize power to build their own empire. And the Romans couldn't rally these people around anymore because there was no longer a Roman identity to rally around.
It's such an obvious lesson. And it's amazing that it needs to be learned the hard way. But then it's amazing that it gets forgotten. And now we have to learn it all over again the hard way. I mean, it's interesting to, when you chart it there quickly, I can see the mechanism. I can see how one thing leads to another. because they've basically dissolved the center. So then there's nothing to be loyal to. And again, you see this nowadays. You see national leaders proudly saying that, well, there's no such thing as Swedish culture. There's no such thing as English culture. There's no such thing as Canadian culture. So therefore, we're just open to people bringing whatever they have to the mix and throwing it into the cauldron. But that isn't actually how it works. They bring their stuff to, but it doesn't get dissolved in the cauldron. There is no cauldron. What there is endless tension, because nobody knows what the situation is. This is actually what I saw when I was 19, when I moved to London. I immediately noticed this, that in multiracial London, no one group, it was a particular part of London, no one group was in charge, and therefore there was no actual culture. That you couldn't say the culture of that area. That area did not have a culture. It had many cultures all looking at each other nervously and suspiciously, and not really mixing. So I mean, they rubbed alongside each other, and I think this is maybe the difference between then and now, is that today we have so much comfort, we have such material wealth that you can sort of stave off at least attempts to take over by just keeping people comfortable, bread and circuses. But what you can't make happen is for them to feel that they are all one group, because they're not.
Yeah, and you know, the Romans weren't exactly known for being domestically wealthy. It was only for the nobles. So that system broke down. I mean, again, like the total time from the Goths entering the Roman Empire to this dissolving of the empire is only 50 years. Now, with our wealth, maybe we can last a century. I don't know. Our wealth is already dissolving very quickly as it gets ransacked by foreign interests. I'm not sure if that wealth is real anymore. It's you know, largely financialized, largely based off of debt and pretending like you have money. We may be quickly becoming just like the Romans in that late era when they just didn't have the money or resources to keep everyone entertained and stable and fed. And then it falls apart in years, not centuries.
Yeah, it is remarkable how fast this happens. As you say, 50 years is nothing, really.
And that's the thing, like they crossed the Rhine in 406. And Rome was sacked by 410. It only took 4 years for it to hit the capital, for those political games to hit the capital. And then it just staggered for like 44 more years, 46 more years as like they tried to resolve this, like, oh, who is this empire for question. They never resolved it. It broke. It became medieval Europe. And you got the idea of kingdoms where, you know, the idea of a medieval kingdom was you had the ruling tribe, you know, appointed by the Pope, and he did oversee other tribes in those territories, but it was understood the king and his people are what this kingdom is for. You always have to ask, well, who is it for? Because the Romans couldn't answer that question for 50 years, everything just went to hell. Like, it's so fast. Like, there's a really good text, actually by a pagan, Rutilius, what's his name? I have it written right here. Rutilius Pneumaticus. Have you heard of him?
No.
Rutilius Pneumaticus. He writes in like the 420s after Rome had been ransacked, and he's a pagan Romano-Gothic guy who has given up on the empire because it's no longer, it's not even for Rome, it's not for him, he's just given up. And he wrote this text called My Voyage Home to Gaul, in which he documents things that his father had built that he was now visiting the ruins of. And it's very depressing. It's an early example of a post-apocalyptic literature, even though it's like it's not fiction. It's a real actual apocalypse. And the sense you get as he's describing these beautiful things that his father had built as a Roman provincial person, like a noble, like a governor, and he's just visiting them in a state of ruins, being trodden, like seeing the Goths topple the statues and ransacked the cities that his father had built. The sense that you get is, like, as he constantly says, like this empire isn't for anyone anymore. It's not serving anyone. It's just serving whoever can get the gold off the temple walls the fastest to pay troops to protect them. It's a very depressing text if you happen to read it, but it's also a very insightful text about, like, the question of who is this empire for never gets answered. And it's constantly trying to be answered, but no one can say that without ultimately saying, well, you are in this empire, but you're not who this empire is for. No one has the galls to say that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, is in struggling to answer this question, why couldn't the Romans just say the difficult thing? Why couldn't they just make the choice? Well, it's for us. It's for the ethnic Romans, and it was a mistake to ever allow other people an equal footing. Why couldn't they just say it's for us?
You know, now that you ask that so directly, I do wonder. I could, you know, take the Uber Boyo approach and blame, like, the liberal Christians at the time expanding that. But in the pagan literature, you don't really see them asking that question either. They're more concerned with the rites and traditions of what made Rome strong, the Roman virtue. They never really go into the Roman people as a distinct group that deserves to lead this empire. They're more interested in virtue. I'd almost want to say the Romans, by the end, regardless if you were a Christian or pagan, they were all too progressive and liberal. They talked about virtue. They talked about faith. They talked about loyalty to the gods or God, but never the Roman people themselves. Rutilius Nomatinus, I think in one point in his text, he comes close where he laments that he had outlived his fatherland. I think that's a line that he says, which is a really tragic line. I had outlived my fatherland, which is I think it's the closest you get to someone realizing that this was once for you. It was once your fatherland, but now the Goths run it. Now the Gauls are running it. Now the Italians are ransacking it for their coffers. It's no longer for any particular people. It's for whoever can grab the gold the fastest. There are hints at attempting to answer that question in the literature. There's another guy, Salvian, who's a Gallo-Roman, who's famous for saying, it's not the strong bodies of the barbarians nor the weakness of our character that we're losing our empire, but rather because we live vicious lives. And I don't know, it's he goes on a bit of a tangent on, like, he's more from the Gallic faction, so he's trying to say the empire's for this new Gallo-Roman stronghold. He's trying to say it's for him now, his people, but he's only able to really say, we live vicious lives, not like our fathers. It's almost approaching a people group, but I don't think the Romans wanted to think in terms of a people group. They almost feared it. They almost thought it was, like, verboten, like too backwards for them to talk like that, which is really weird because, you know, obviously you go back just 200 years and you have clear literature from, like, you know, Cato and others, like, you know, this empire's for the Romans. We're going to beat the Carthaginians up and take their stuff for our people. That dies in probably by the 200s. It's gone. The literature stops talking about the Roman people and starts talking about the virtues that made Rome great, right? It's kind of like abstracting the identity, dissolving the identity.
What are our values?
Yeah. And this is something that you definitely see it more with the Christians. I'm going to place the blame on the Christians on this one, where, you know, even like Augustine, he's talking about the virtues of the Romans that made them great, and that's why they lost the virtues, so they're losing the empire. But I can't recall reading a pagan really directly talking about ethnicity either. They're also talking about the virtue of the gods, the virtue of the rites of the old religion. They're never really talking about the people themselves and what made them great, because they were a kin group, a brotherhood of people seeking the benefit of their tribe. That really does seem to die out by the second century almost.
That's amazing. And it seems that from that point on, it's basically a ticking clock. the point that conception is abandoned.
And I think that's maybe something to emphasize. I hadn't thought about emphasizing it, but it's definitely something to emphasize that it really does seem like it was a ticking clock. Like immediately once Roman identity starts expanding to other tribes, you get the crisis of the third century. And then when they piece themselves together, they just refuse to look at what made the Roman people great as a people, rather than like, you know, oh, we have virtues where we honor our contracts. We were civic nationalists. I have a list of quotes here trying to find something like that. Sidonius Apollonianus said, these are paraphrases I wrote down, but like, we are abandoned, not a soldier, not a piece of gold, not a word of encouragement reaches us from the emperor or his court. They think more of dancing girls and the races than of the provinces which will perish, which is kind of interesting. I thought I saw something. Rutilius Numanticus says something along the lines of our country is dying and we are exiles at home, which is a really interesting phrase. He's really the closest that comes to touching the ethnic question. Again, he's visiting a lot of the ruined areas of the Roman Empire after the Goths have ransacked it. And so he's able to remember when Romans were here. And he has that ancient tradition to like remember when there were Romans here, living here, keeping it great. But again, even as he touches the ethnic question, he immediately goes into the virtue of the old gods, rather than, because he's a pagan, rather than the virtue of the old Romans.
Right, okay. All right. Well, it's been an interesting lecture, so thank you for that. There are a few super chats. Hold on a second. From Donnie. Don, she says, awesome guest today. Thank you. Thank you very much, Don. Soaker City asks, it's a tangential question, and here we go. Was pre-submerged Doggerland Atlantis or Hyperborea?
Should I attempt to answer that?
I don't know. You go for it. I don't know if you have any knowledge or interest in these things.
I have a little interest. I mean, it wasn't really populated by a nation. It was populated by ancient hunter-gatherers who, I think we found like mammoth skulls there with spearheads in them. So there were bold hunters in those lands, but they're underwater now. No, I don't think it was Atlantis or Hyperborea. I think it was just a land of giant animals and bold hunters that unfortunately went under the water.
Right. And then there's this super chat from the Wanderer. He says, have you read A Jewish Princedom in Feudal France by Arthur J. Zuckerman from 1972? It always intrigued me of the historic presence of Jews in Provence, even having developed their own language in Comtat Venetian called Judeo-Provençal, which flourished between the 11th and 19th centuries, with the last speaker being Armand Lunel, who died in 1977. The book is called A Jewish Princedom in Feudal France.
I didn't get into it too much, but like after the Roman government is gone and the Merovingians and later Carolinians are ruling there, there's a lot of controversial things they did with the Jewish people in southern France. Obviously, there were refugees from Italy that had moved there and they had lived there for a while. They seem to have ransacked a lot of the dying embers of the Roman Empire, quite frankly. And it's one of the, I guess, the stains on Charlemagne's dynasty is that he permitted them too much economic power in southern France, and it's thought that this may have been one of the reasons why the Muslims were able to enter Spain, is that like these mercantile interests were not particularly concerned with the local ethnicity and their governors, and so Muslims ask for entry and they get in.
I've forgotten what the gates were called. I should know.
Toulis, the gates of Toulis, or
Where is yeah, it? Talise, I think so.
You know, in post-Roman Southern Gaul is interesting because, again, it still has a little bit of Greek in it. It still has that little piece of connection to the ancient world. And so when Charlemagne, first the Merovingians take over, and they are interesting in the sense that they're not really in charge. The Merovingians take over because the local Gallo-Romans want anything that can protect them from the barbarians. And so they hire the Merovingians to rule over them. They literally hire a king. And the Merovingians set up their administration and rule as the Gallo-Romans run the government in the cities. And there's a famous quote about them towards the end of their dynasty that I think Gregory of Tours says, all they did was ride around in a carriage and wave about their frolicking hair to the allure of the population. They basically became like cultural rock stars while the Gallo-Romans were still running the government. I believe there's one example of this on, I forget who, I think it might have been Gregory of Tours also, or Jordan's talking about the Franks. He says that one of the Merovingian kings bought a chariot from the Eastern Roman Empire with golden letters saying "Viva Romana" or something like "Long Live Rome," and he's like a German king rolling around France like a rock star in this like "Viva Rome Forever" like a bumper sticker. He's like a rock star basically, and these are not real kings; they are rock stars keeping the people distracted from the utter devastation they're living in. But the one benefit that they serve when they're put in by the Gallo-Romans is that you have this sensitive young man to build an ethnicity around. The French identity builds around these rock star kings, first the Merovingians, later the Carolinians. Later on, the Carolinian dynasty, they start as mayors in Paris. They're just mayors under the Merovingian kings. But I think Pepin the Short or something writes a letter to the Pope and being like, hey, we're actually running the show here. The Merovingians are just rock stars. Can you make me a king instead? And the Pope's like, yeah, sure. And so they buy the throne from the papacy. It's still very mercantile. There are embers of a new identity growing in France throughout the 500s through 800s, but you're not really seeing an ethnic identity formulate until they have to defeat the Muslims. When the Carolingian dynasty arises, yeah, they bought the throne. They didn't really earn it, but they did fight in many battles and rally the people and create the idea of the French people. And that embryo identity that forms fighting the Muslims grows into the French ethnic identity over time. So while I can make fun of them for like being rock stars and driving around chariots with bumper stickers on them, they do provide this stable, you know, here's a cool looking white guy with which to relate to. I want to be like him. And so it creates a kind of identity to center around. And that does allow the French identity to start to develop embryonically into a real living thing.
Right. Okay. Well, let's end it there. This has been interesting. It just affirms something that's very common in our circles, which is the assumption that ethnic identity matters and is a source of strength and a source of stability and consistency. And as soon as you sacrifice that, you face very serious problems.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, thank you very much for this appearance on Millennial Elf. It's been an unusual episode for Millennial, but I tend to have one like this each year. It tends to happen. So,
my apologies for being a bit rushed and not as planned as I would like, but I do hope that. If you take anything away from this, it's a state can only serve one people.
Exactly. Yeah, and I should say that this was meant to happen a few days from now, but because of the distributist, we moved this one forward. So thank you to Elf for adapting like that. All right. Well, I'll be back in about 10 minutes with the AMA. But in the meantime, Eilf, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.